Okay, everybody take your seats. We won't bring into formal order yet. I don't know if we've got a quorum, but if the Department of Corrections wants to come to the table and begin.
This is kind of scary if I'm the lead guy up here.
Commissioner. However you folks would like to start your continuation of your presentation, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, good morning.
At some point, I'll probably break in for a roll call in a minute, so go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, we did actually complete our presentation, but we sensed at the end of the day last week that there perhaps were more questions from you folks. In terms of refreshing our presentation, we actually had two parts of the presentation. If you recall, the first part was basically an overview, and the second part of the presentation was more specifically attuned to the medical parts of our operation. So I would be inclined maybe just to very quickly go through the first part of our presentation again, just to refresh members, and I would defer to you for some direction on that.
Actually, that sounds like a good idea, so go ahead.
Very good.
Commissioner.
And again, lots of these comments are overview, high-level kinds of points, but we'll go through those very quickly. Again, the sentencing guidelines and the philosophy of the state of Minnesota basically is to lock up the most serious offenders, and the sentencing guidelines give us a lot of direction on that. We have major partners in the probation and parole world in the community with our community corrections and county partners. And a driving philosophy for us always is to give offenders an opportunity to change if they so desire, because if they change, that certainly makes for a safer community. And this slide should be very familiar to us all at this point, and it's a comparison of similarly situated states and the prison populations of those states, ranking Minnesota number 49.
Commissioner, if we could just interrupt you for a second for our formalities here. I think we've got a quorum, so we'll start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery.
Here.
Bathier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer. Kriesel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald. Moran. Nornis. Slocum.
Yeah, thank you. And with that, let's entertain a motion from someone for approve the minutes of Thursday, February 24th. Okay, moved by Representative Hilty to approve the minutes. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. And Commissioner, you can start again. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I failed to introduce the people to my right and left. To my left, Assistant Commissioner Lisa Ogroski. To my right, David Crisp, Deputy Commissioner. To continue the presentation, we are a large organization with over 4,000 employees, with major facilities. In addition to our prison facilities, we also have the responsibility for over 20,000 in the community. And again, for those members who weren't present at the start here, we're just doing a very brief overview that you have already seen, just to refresh the discussion. We have three divisions of correctional institutions, our community services pass-through, and our operations support. Three major delivery systems in the state of Minnesota: the Department of Corrections, Community Corrections Act, and the county probation officer system, reflected on the map that's included. It is. We'll get through this. This is basically the overview presentation that you had 2 weeks ago, and we will, after this short presentation, kick back into the one that you saw last week as well. But again, probation, supervised release. Supervised release is considered our parole system. The demographics of offenses, and this is always probably the most interesting slide in this presentation, and this is really the recidivism presentation, that felony offenders that stay crime-free from committing new felonies, 96% within 6 months, within 3 years, 85% don't commit a new felony. We're going to conclude this presentation and move quickly into the other one that was the subject area last week.
Commissioner, could we hesitate for a question here from Representative Gauthier?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, and you'll probably get through it in your presentation, but I have a couple of questions. How do prisoners become eligible for chemical dependency treatment?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to defer to David Crist, who has the responsibility for that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gaultier, when offenders are admitted to our facility, either at St. Cloud or Shakopee, those are our two intake facilities, they go through a battery of assessments, including chemical dependency assessments. There they are reviewed for either abuse or addiction. We take a look at the amount of time they've got to serve. We take a look at other criminogenic needs, and we rank them according to their need. Then we try to take all those factors into account and get the offenders with the most need into the programs in our facilities.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Crist, when they go to the 90-bed facility, is that at the front end or the back end of their sentence?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gaultier, it's more likely the middle to the back end of their sentence.
Okay. Mr. Chair, is there any reimbursement the department gets for providing services, like through consolidated fund or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, did you have another one? Representative Leidiger.
Just a reminder, I know we ended last week. We were actually getting into discussion on cost-cutting measures and kind of a response to the your response to the chairman's letter. Are we going into that at some point here?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we will go anywhere where you desire this morning, and we can certainly respond to some of those concerns. We have a lot of those are preliminary, of course, but we can certainly do our best to respond to you.
Well, one of them was certainly the outsourcing, so I just wanted to pick up on that at some point. So if you'd address that today, I'd appreciate it. Outsourcing of prisoner of using other private prisons, basically.
Commissioner, if you had time to I know it's a big subject, think it over or have a response for the private prison question that we've been chasing around for years.
Mr. Chair, Representative, privatization of prisons is a major issue, and I would beg this committee, actually, if we are going to give attention to that, that we set aside some major time to discuss that and allow us to put a presentation together. It is no light subject, and I know we have a series of conference We have some meetings set up in that regard already, and if in fact that is a subject area that we want to give good attention to, I would ask that we have sufficient time to do that and time to prepare. We can certainly make some preliminary comments today. Deputy Commissioner Crist has been engaged in this discussion in prior years, but again, it certainly is an area that we are totally aware of.
Commissioner Crist, I'm sorry, go ahead. Commissioner Crist, why don't you go ahead and take a whack at it and give us what you know about it. Since it's been talked about for years and we've had hours of debate on the House floor, you should have some opinion probably. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger, let me give you some background on where we've been in the past few years with it. I brought our projections chart up on the screen there for you. When populations were increasing quickly in the early part of the 2000s, we found ourselves in a position where we had to rent beds in order to place all the offenders that were in our system. We did that until last summer, actually, or a year ago, February probably, when we rented beds at the Prairie Correctional Facility. At one point, we had several hundred inmates out in that facility, and as our department's need for beds started to level off for a couple of reasons. One, there were fewer intake, as you can see by the projections, started happening in the late 2000s. But we also brought prison beds on at our Faribault facility in greater numbers. We added 1,000 beds to Faribault. We added 150 beds to Stillwater. And our need for rental beds started to level off. We reduced the number of offenders that were out at the Prairie facility in the past couple of years then, until it reached a point in their business model where it wasn't profitable for them to remain open. We shifted those offenders into county jails in the last couple of years, and now our population, our admissions are leveling off to the point where we don't need to have anybody in county jails right now either. So currently we're not renting beds, private or public, from anyone. We are covering all of our bed space needs internally. Now, in the out years, the plan has been that we would start to rent beds first from the jails and probably up around 300 beds in county jails for offenders, after which point it gets a little hard to keep track of those guys in terms of the casework that they need and the reentry that they need. And after that point, we would either have to plan to rent beds again from a private entity such as Prairie Correctional in Appleton, Minnesota, or we would have to bring a plan to the legislature to add prison beds to one of our existing facilities.
Representative Leidiger?
Well, like in any outsourcing plan, I mean, there's multiple options. I mean, there are other states that have prison space, and outsourcing outside the state, I'm sure, is an option. If we have overcapacity, then we can have certainly some cost savings in looking at dismantling certain segments of the system. Have we looked at outside the state,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger, we really haven't had to do that in the past several years. There are inherent advantages. If we're going to rent beds, there are inherent advantages to having them right in the state of Minnesota so that we can continue our casework that we've got to do with those guys, so that we can work out reentry plans, which are going to occur into Minnesota counties. And so we haven't in the past looked outside of the state. That's by no means am I saying we wouldn't be willing to look at every option into the future.
Representative Leidiger?
All right. I don't have, well, we know looking at other states have done this. We know that there's, that there are, there's facilities that can do it for half the, for that can house this population for half the cost of what we're paying currently. And this is an area that I think we should explore and certainly look at doing something like this in the future. We have a, it looks like as though we've got a falling off of that population, slight increase in some of the out years, you know, and of course it should dovetail, I think, the consideration of outsourcing should dovetail with the maintenance of certain facilities and overhauling of certain facilities. There may be a time in which it's just right to do so and do it at a time when maintenance issues come into play and it makes sense to do so. There's probably a lot more that needs to be said on that. And if they have a working group on that, it's something that I think we should have that group report to us on a periodic basis.
Thank you. Mr. Carter, without getting into the conclusions of for or against or whether it's a good idea or not, how much research have we done in the past? Would we have to start at ground zero again, or are there some pertinent time-sensitive studies that we could refer to now that would give us an idea on cost-benefit and what they're doing in other states?
Mr. Chair, committee members, there is a lot of research on privatization, and the research goes both ways. Some say there's savings, some say there's no savings. So, I mean, that's basically out there, but there's a lot of studies out there. But I should also point out that Corrections does use some privatization right now. Their health care, as was discussed the other day, is a private company, and I still believe their food service is a private company.
And it would be a big controversial issue, I'll bring it up. It'd be a union issue and an argument about the care of the inmates either way, and so it would take some time, but I don't think we'd have to start from zero. And I imagine you folks, after addressing the subject a number of times and questions, would have some information also that you could put, you know, some opinion and work on. Representative Muller, Mr. Carter?
There are some states, though, that I should point out, Mr. Chairman, committee members, that are, when they're contracting out with the private company, they say they stipulate in the contract that it has to be a savings of either 5 or 10%.
Representative Muller?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say I've read some studies that get into the other side of it, and maybe our research staff knows of some, but where there's almost no help for the inmates with things like mental health, chemical dependency, training them for jobs and things that I'm especially worried about our prisoners, because a lot of them come back into the inner city afterwards when they first get out. And so that's a huge issue as to whether a private prison is doing as good a job at getting them ready for reentry into our communities.
Okay. If there's no other questions, Commissioner, you can proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, just one additional feature that Mr. Crisp did mention is that a lot of our friends in the counties during the time when these populations were increasing did make major building improvements to their county jails and justice centers, and the bed capacity in our county jails, is open bed capacity, is pretty significant right now. And so it, and I know it's, some members are aware of those local jails and their population issues. So, and the Department of Corrections, when we contract for those beds, it's at $55 a day for those sheriffs, and it's a pretty important feature for them when they do get those prisoners back in their facilities. Again, you folks have seen these numbers before, and our purpose here is just to refresh for future questions. Obviously, the sentencing guidelines has driven our population. People with very serious criminal convictions, criminal histories, end up in our prisons. Our inmate profile, because of the sentencing guidelines, primarily focuses on person crimes. The sentencing guidelines are weighted to those crimes. Hence, we see more of those folks in prison. The other offenders usually find themselves, the property offenders, the drug offenders, DWI traffic cases, find themselves under community supervision. And again, what we talked about last time was the fact that our facilities operate 24/7, 365. The flow of inmates and offenders to us is not something we control. It is driven by the court system. And we talked about the reductions that have happened over the years. The governor's proposed budget, and we certainly didn't get into this during our last session, so if you members want to ask more questions about this, Assistant Commissioner Ogrosky made a presentation on these next two slides, and if she wants to again summarize those at this point, that might be helpful.
Yeah, Commissioner, if you want to expand on that a little, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Lisa Ogrosky, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. This slide reflects our general fund budget and the governor's recommendation of $915 million for the biennium. Broken out by division, it's about 72% for facilities, 4.5% for operations support, 8.5% for community services. That's the DOC portion of that. And then the pass-through funding for our community partners of $15.3 million. Your biennial budget pages, as I mentioned last time, show this to be a 2.4% increase in general fund dollars. However, that figure is distorted due to the fact that our tails were impacted by federal stimulus money. This is actually a 1.74% reduction for our agency. The first change item we talk about is what I had just mentioned about our tails issue. Fiscal year 10, we received $38 million in federal stimulus money, and our general fund budget was reduced by that same amount. In fiscal year 11, that $38 million was restored to the general fund. The tails for 12 and 13 were shorted $13.473 and $474 for fiscal years 12 and 13. So this first change item actually covers base funding that the agency currently has in this fiscal year. It's an equivalent of about half of St. Cloud's budget, or around 200 positions.
We presented these equivalents not as a plan for reduction, but only to give some sense of scale of what this money means to us. So it's not an insignificant amount of money.
Mr. Chair, the next change item relates to chemical dependency treatment at Faribault that Representative Gaultier referred to earlier. A couple of years ago, we were fortunate enough to get a grant from the Department of Justice to allow us to double our treatment beds there from 90 to 180. That grant expires on December 31st of this year, and the change item would continue the funding from the general fund so that we wouldn't have to back off of those 180 beds back to the previous level of 90. Chemical dependency treatment in our facilities has been studied and shown to reduce recidivism by 27%. So it's a significant public safety factor to have these treatment beds.
Mr. Chair, we also have a few budget reductions. The first one is an operating budget reduction, and it's cuts to each division in the agency. It's a total of $1,051,000 for each year of the biennium. It includes positions that we've determined to eliminate, people who had taken advantage of the early retirement incentive, and also some vacant positions that we will not fill.
And if you recall, we drew your attention to this because this, in fact, impacts our community partners and Community Corrections Act and our county friends, and additionally, the supervision of offenders by our department. dollar amounts for those reductions. We presented those as being proportional and certainly would impact, and some of the questions asked at the last session here were related to the importance of community supervision in our overall strategy. And the bottom point there, that again, for scale purposes, this is equivalent to about 22 supervision officers, probation officers, if in fact that was the strategy chosen by our local partners. And the question asked last time was about the 1,500 to 2,000 offenders, and my answer was hopefully those are lowest risk offenders. And I said that most agencies have pretty sophisticated risk assessments currently in place, and those types of offenders are pretty easily identified. This particular reduction is to a community corrections program in Dodge, Fillmore, Olmsted Community Corrections, and it was a pilot, and this money is used to enhance their sex offender programming. This was the brief presentation that we made, and at this point, if you recall last session, we launched into the discussion of our medical services, and this group had many questions related to the delivery of those medical services. I think since you have that presentation in your hand and ask a lot of questions, we would probably defer and prefer not to do that overview again, and maybe open it up to more general questions about what we just presented you again, or any other questions that might be of interest to you.
Thank you, Commissioner. A couple of them off. Can you tell us if your per diem is going to go up from 2,000 to 2,010 to 11, and how much, and if so, and why?
Mr. Chair, from 2010 to 2011?
Yes.
It should go down. I can't tell you the amount off the top of my head, but it should go down a little bit. And mostly that is because we've been able to fill up the beds at Faribault. We're not in a construction mode anymore down there, and the beds for the fiscal year should be full the entire year.
Okay, and have you had a chance to react yet to the governor's new change in the budget as far as your department? Had any ideas, or if he told anything that you're going to get?
Mr. Chair, members.
Commissioner.
We reviewed that yesterday afternoon, and in the comments made by Mr. Showalter, the Department of Corrections was not mentioned as a beneficiary of the new projections. We have not had any direct conversation, but I will keep my fingers crossed.
Okay. Representative McDonald, first up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, in the Department OSR, and relating to the CPO, otherwise known as Offender Supervision Reduction, and then your Community Corrections Act, I see that that fund is going to have a reduction. The governor recommends a reduction of $1,565,000, and I see that that particularly affects over 70% of the state's population with 32 counties. My question is, under his proposal, it says these reductions will be managed by using alternative strategies with low-risk offenders, not high-risk. What strategies will the counties do to manage them by using alternative strategies with these low-risk offenders?
Commissioner? Sir.
Representative, I came out of that community environment just recently, and our strategies can vary significantly. And as I mentioned, community corrections agencies universally are using a risk assessment tool that clearly identifies those offenders. Typically, alternatives that are considered for low-risk offenders can be group reporting, sometimes called service centers, where you might have 150 or 200 offenders come in at one time in an evening session, update the probation officer about their compliance with their conditions. Judges sometimes use more aggressive fines for low-risk offenders. If there's restitution involved, sometimes judges are satisfied if restitution is paid as a alternative to any probation involvement. Sometimes there's specific local programming that can be used for low-risk offenders. There might be a evening session on shoplifting. There could be a clinic specifically for domestic abuse or violence. If it's a simple assault, there might be some violence counseling. Local mental health facilities are sometimes used, and if a low-risk offender satisfies that he's attended AA for the past 6 months, sometimes that's a reasonable strategy for low-risk offenders. So it's a variety of strategies that people use in the community. And the one caveat to that, however, is that some communities are pretty limited in the resources they have for low-risk offenders. Sometimes judges will just say, we're going to check your record in a year, and if you're clean, and if you're, it shows that your record is clean for the past year, then you'll satisfy our sentence. So it's a variety of things, and there's no magic bullet that's used by everybody.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I would submit that obviously in all our agencies there is room for to do things more effectively and cost affordably. The question is, in your opinion, does this department, does this this particular change item that deals with probation issues and the low-risk offenders, if by cutting this, do we potentially risk those recidivism, that those low-risk offenders will then become high-risk offenders, therefore clogging the system up and costing us even more money in the future? Do you see this as a viable source for getting these folks on track of living a healthy, productive life?
Commissioner? Chair. Representative, I wish there was an unlimited pool of money to devote to all offenders. The strategy that I've just talked about is, in an environment with limited resources, to focus those resources on the medium to high risk offenders. I think I totally agree with you. We can do good work with all offenders, and I wish I could develop resources in all communities that would respond to those offenders. And I would agree with you that when we limit our involvement with offenders of any risk, we do run the risk of increasing recidivism. The science shows that. But there is a rather strange phenomenon in the world of criminal justice now, and the gurus in the criminology departments at various universities have proven this beyond a reasonable doubt, that for certain low-risk offenders, if you provide too much criminal justice services to them, you can actually increase their recidivism. And that's really counterintuitive. And when I first read that, I thought, how the heck can that be? But it involves the associations that sometimes low-risk offenders are put into. If they're put into a program with higher-risk offenders, sometimes rather than the good rubbing off on the bad, sometimes the bad rubs off on the good folk. And so we have to be very cautious about over-serving low-risk offenders. And we can't minimize the impact of arrest and going through court. For lots of offenders, that miserable experience changes their life. And getting caught has a big impact on a lot of offenders. And sometimes that's not very apparent right away, but the statistics show that first-time offenders, we sometimes never see them again.
Okay. Commissioner, we do a good job on, it seems like, the 49th ranked in the number we incarcerate, but the ones that we do return to incarceration rank 5. You just give us, what do you think the reasons are for that? Minnesota has a problem there, or how we can improve, or course, you touched on some of it already with talking about the supervised release, but it seems like kind of a dismal ranking there.
Mr. Chair, I mentioned at our last session that the good work done by very courageous corrections officials 25 to 35 years ago when they developed the Community Corrections Act and when the sentencing guidelines were developed, and Minnesota was certainly a leader in the development of sentencing guidelines. Those two philosophies have brought us to the point in time here where we have a very efficient criminal justice corrections system. Hence, we have not had the prison building crisis that many states are facing. And certainly our demographics in Minnesota have helped in this regard too, where we have not had phenomenal population growth in the state. Our cold weather certainly filters social issues. We are healthy. Many metrics that we use to judge Minnesota, we rank very high. And I'm pleased to say that in the corrections world, we are ranked nearly the best. Can we improve? And I think this is the question you're asking. Are there strategies to improve? I think it's time to revisit the sentencing guidelines in some areas. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission certainly has produced some pretty revealing reports in the past few years talking about various offender types and maybe some alternative strategies. This week, the legislative auditor is going to be releasing a very important report on sex offender strategies that should be of interest to a lot of people around this table, and we're very anxious to comment on that report as well. But we, as a state and sometimes as a system, we sometimes get caught up in very narrow areas of concern. And sometimes those areas of concern can significantly impact our populations in prisons. And into the future, we really need to be concerned about whether our adjustments, either to our correctional philosophy, our sentencing guidelines philosophy, we need to be very concerned if those strategies will have impact long time into the future. Lifetime supervision of some offender groups, addressing certain offenders more aggressively under the sentencing guidelines. All of those things could impact how we do business into the future. And I hope that long-winded response got to some of your concerns, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I was talking about actually the percent of parolees returned to incarceration, supervised release in Minnesota, ranked 5, and why they were so high. And I know we do good on the other route, but
Mr. Chair, I just reviewed those numbers this morning, actually, and there was a pretty comprehensive report done that's in my briefcase, actually, and that particular hearings and release unit is what we call it, HRU. They review all parole violator, supervised release violator cases. About half of those are not returned. They review about 2,000 annually, and only about half of those are actually revoked and returned to the institution. The other half are restructured back into the community. And that restructure back into the community can involve additional treatment in the community. It can involve local jail time. It can involve restructuring their conditions of release. So the report indicates that our preference really is not to send people back. And as a old parole officer in my previous life, I was often challenged by the hearings people to find community alternatives rather than return them to prison. And I would encourage, and we will make available that full report to you because it is very revealing. And I know Representative, you had some concerns about that as well.
I know I am sensitive to your comment about sentencing guidelines and how many people we send to prison, but on our side of the table here, we have to be sensitive also. Some say it was an overreaction to Drew Shudeen that caused a lot of change and cost us a lot more money. But of course, we have to weigh that. Some people would almost maybe rather pay more money for certain things. And a sex offender, of course, the bill is up on Thursday. We're going to talk about that in the sex offender program. That's one of those things we're trying to consider now, is whether if that program is actually getting the job done, especially when they're walking away faster than they can release them. So it's going to take a lot of thought, cost versus the safety of our community. So I agree with you. It's a sensitive subject. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, we talked a little bit about this last week, but I want to revisit it on community supervision and those cuts there that totaled 22 supervision positions. Really up to the counties to decide whether or not they're going to cut a supervision position, isn't it? It's not really the DOC or our purview with those dollars. They could choose to not buy new computers or lay off a secretary or not fill a position or whatever, correct?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative, you're absolutely right. And again, we just, to give you a sense of scale of what that money translates to, we offered those. But clearly, most agencies probably have unfilled positions currently open. I mean, that's been a pretty common strategy. And they could choose to not fill a support position. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think part of the concern comes then is probation and parole people have too many people to supervise on their caseload. I know that's something I hear about when I go home. Do you think that this cut is significant enough to worry about higher recidivism?
Commissioner?
Chair, Representative. I would be a fool to say that any reduction in staff would make things better. I will never say that. And as a former administrator of probation officers, the more the better, because I know the good work they do and I know the impact they have on community safety. But at this level, knowing that there are low-risk offenders on those caseloads, I think it is not an unreasonable risk to take if we are indeed serious about reducing public costs.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think Representative Gauthier got to most of my questions, but as long as I have a second, could you give me some idea how many agents are statewide? If we did look at that proposed reduction of 22 agents, how many in context are there statewide? So we have some idea what we're talking about. Ballpark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I cannot answer that question statewide. Obviously, the county officers, the community corrections officers, and the state officers would add up to that. And I...
Mr. Chair, you can get that at a later date.
That's all right. That's no big deal.
We would.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner, and Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm pretty good friends for a long time with a probation officer, and I do think they do good work. And my concern also would be that they are overloaded. You know what I mean, from my observation, and it's minimal. I just, in a small area, but the number of cases they have to keep track of is very high, and to create even a higher load, I have some concerns about that. So But so I just echo some of those same comments. But I do have some summary comments on the healthcare discussion from the last meeting. I don't know if this is the appropriate time to state those, or I should wait for a better time, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Representative Grenegan.
Okay. I'll try to be brief. You know, from our discussion last week, just a couple observations on the CMS reimbursement. You know, there seemed to be a variance in reimbursement. I don't know if variance is the right way, but a range of reimbursement rates to the providers. It was, you know, talked about Medicare, talked about 175% over Medicare reimbursement. And to me, I would like to see a standard adopted closer to a Medicaid reimbursement if possible. I can live with Medicare too. And but anything over that, I think, is excessive. I know you try to keep, 70% of the treatment on site, and there has to be an incentive to do that. I understand that. But to me, you should standardize the reimbursement rate comparatively to law-abiding citizens. And I don't want to underserve these people in any way. I don't want them to put their health at risk. But the fact is, we have standards of reimbursement out there that can be referenced. Second thing is, when it came to deciding what's covered, it seemed like there wasn't a standard to decide that. It was left to a board of medical necessity, if I remember right. And to me, that seems, is that correct, Mr. Commissioner?
Commissioner?
Those were the words used by our medical director, yes.
Okay. To me, that seems, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Grenegan?
Yeah, Commissioner. To me, that seems arbitrary, both in terms of if I'm a person, you know, in the jail, which I really don't want to be, but, you know, if you're in the jail, you're asking for a medical service. You have a board arbitrarily deciding what's covered, what's not. To me, why not adopt a standard, what's covered by Medicaid, for example, and the federal mandates? And I'd prefer the federal mandates because the federal mandates are much lower than the state mandates, which are about twice as high. So I, you know, just to get the input on that, if we standardize those things and gave an outside reference, oh, Ms. Larson, you want more of me, right? Just kidding. I didn't even ask permission to make that comment, Mr. Chair, sorry. Anyway, to me, that would bring take the variability out of the reimbursement rates, plus give a standard of what's covered and not covered. Last comment in summary, state employee roles. And this is just an initial comment, okay? When I look over the services that are provided, nursing, dental, non-psychiatric mental health care, I'm not quite sure what that is, but anyway, medical records, SO treatment, CD treatment, we're spending about almost $35 million a year on those services. I personally think the majority, if not all of those services, should be put out to bid by private contractors. Now, I would not be opposed if state employees formed a unit to bid on those services, okay? That'd be fine. They could be one of the people that bid. But what I found being on the school board for 16 years, when you put a bid process out, you tend to increase efficiency, reduce your cost, and provide the service better than just an ongoing situation where state employees provide a service, and human nature being what it is, when you provide a service the next year, you'd like to be reimbursed a little bit higher for those services. So again, when I look over those services, I think we should be looking at, you know, putting that out for bids on most, if not all, of those services, especially with the dollar amount that's involved for those services. Anyway, those are my summary comments, if you have any response.
Commissioner Larson, or Director, do you have any comments? Would you like to totally agree with Representative Grunhagen?
Mr. Chair, come on. For the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department. And I would like to respond, though, to the mandate issue, because Actually, if we were to follow state mandates, Representative Gruenhagen, we would actually be providing a higher level of care than what we are providing currently. We like to use, and I think if you recall, I talked about, can that person function with that condition safely in prison? So do they need a rotator cuff surgery? Can they go to programming without that rotator cuff surgery? So we want to use that. I also raised the issue of the breast reconstruction surgery. So we don't want to follow state or federal mandates. If you also look at Medicaid, medical assistance, there's also coverage in medical assistance that we don't want to provide either. For example, we provide chiropractic care under MA. We don't provide that. There's a number of them. In my slide, I actually compare what we cover versus what Medicaid covers. So we do like some of that grayness and not having to follow the mandates, because it gives us a little bit more flexibility to not provide that same level of coverage.
Well, Mr. Chair, that
Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah, that does, now that you give that perspective, that does make sense to me if that's, so I find myself tending to agree with that. What about a standardization as far as reimbursement rates?
Director Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, one of the benefits that CMS has brought to us is actually standardizing some reimbursement across the system. We've asked CMS to contract with local providers, and they do that. They negotiate the rates for us, and they've done a really good job of standardizing the reimbursement rates in our hospitals, for example. St. Joe's is where we primarily have our inpatient stays, and they've negotiated a really very good rate for us, about 60% of billed charges. At the other outstate hospitals, we use the Blue Cross Blue Shield rate, so again, a very good standardized rate. The physician and professional services fees are a little bit different, and that's where we don't see as much standardization because those providers are less willing to negotiate with us on those reductions of costs. But I would love it. It would make CMS's life a lot easier if we could figure out some way to standardize reimbursement.
Director Larson, what specifically are the mandates you're referring to that if we went by the mandates, we'd be paying for higher?
Oh, Mr. Chair, for example, the breast reconstruction surgery. That's a mandate for state insurance companies, for HMOs, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and state insurance companies. If a woman has a mastectomy as a result of breast cancer, then the insurance company has to pay for that breast reconstruction surgery as a result thereof.
That's a specific one. I mean, but are there many mandates other than that that you're referring to? I know you referred to the Constitution, but I didn't, you know, that's a real vague one that we want to maybe push the envelope on. But what other mandates besides breast reconstructive surgery?
Mr. Chair, I haven't been in the 62s, Chapter 62s for a while.
Okay.
But I can certainly tell you what some of those mandates would be that we would not necessarily want to cover. We like to use, as I said, the kind of the criteria of medical indication. Is it medically indicated for us to provide that service to that offender so that they can safely live in general population?
Okay, the reason I'm asking, Director Larson, is because when you say mandates that you wouldn't really want to cover, that means that you somehow have an option. So I would like to know what mandates you have to live by and which ones you don't, so we know if we want to cut back on some treatment, where it would be. If you could furnish a list of the mandates you're talking about by statute or rule. Thank you. Representative Gruenhagen, if we could move along a little bit, go ahead.
And this will be quick. For the record, I favor the federal mandates versus the state, because on my comments at least, although I'd like your rebuttal to my comments, a little bit better than that even, but the federal mandates are about 50% of what the state mandates are. The second thing is that what about my comment about privatizing and putting out for bid or allowing these services under state employees' roles to be bid on, including state employees being able to form a unit to bid on them if they want. But any thoughts on that?
Director?
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
field that one, please.
Okay.
Representative, the state employees this is a rather fixed group of people and very certain costs. These are employees who provide these services, not necessarily based on a specific treatment or a specific incident. I mean, they're going to be on the job regardless. So it is a pretty predictable cost that, as an administrator, it gives us some satisfaction having it that predictable. If, in fact, services are bid out at a greater degree, as you know, healthcare from year to year can be very unpredictable, and we have seen in the past 14, 15, 16% increases. Needless to say, these employees have not gotten those levels of increases, and they still provide the services that we need. So, again, it's one of these things. What do we value? Do we value predictability, certainty of care, and some control of, in how we present and provide this care versus turning it all over to a private entity? And I would certainly look at the director maybe to add to those comments, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, director? Okay. All right. Couple of more questions from me. What about the early release for elderly, the terminally ill or elderly? I mean, like really elderly. If you thought about that, and several states are considering this, have you done any study on that or policy issues? Or?
Mr. Chairman, let me get situated here and I can address that one.
And then how much authority does the commissioner have on their own to do that?
Mr. Chair, the commissioner has authority to do conditional medical releases. We look at offenders whose medical condition is such that we cannot provide the sort of care that they need in a correctional facility, that there's a balance between the amount of care they need and the cost to the department, and when that all comes into play, we do conditional medical releases of offenders. It's been, over the last 10 years, it's been about two a year, with the exception of 2003 and 2010, where we did 7 and 6 in those years for those offenders. And the other piece that comes into play here is finding a place for those offenders to go. It's very difficult to find nursing homes, for instance, that will take a felon and put them next to somebody's grandmother or grandfather and care for them in that sort of open setting. But it's something that we're open to, and it's something that we use quite a bit more in the last year than we have in the past.
Okay, and then as far as pharmaceutical drug purchases, have you done anything innovative there? There is a study that come out talk about the steps to control prison inmate health care costs, and talks about purchasing programs and less expensive generic drugs, things like this, and group purchasing. What have you done in that area? Has there been any progress? You think you're getting the cheapest you can? Or?
Mr. Chair, there's a couple of things that we've done. CMS purchases all of our pharmaceuticals for us, so they are actually purchasing on behalf of about 225,000 offenders across the country, which makes their purchasing power pretty significant. We use CMS's formulary, albeit we tweak it a hair to be Minnesota-specific. We do use generic drugs. As soon as they go generic, we put them on our formulary, and we make the brand name non-formulary. So there's a couple of hoops that the providers have to go through to prescribe those non-formulary drugs. The other benefit of contracting with CMS is that we can also send back our pharmaceuticals that are unused or unopened, and we get rebates for them. So CMS will give us a credit for medications that we have not been in the hands of the offenders. And we probably get, about $500,000 a year in rebates.
Okay. Members, Representative Leidiger and Mullery, and then we'll probably have to move in pretty quickly to DPS.
I'll go real quick, Mr. Chairman. I apologize, but I want to go back to this slide number 13, because I've been trying to study this and understand this a little bit more. This is the one where it pie chart is there, and it says the correctional institution 71%. This says that 71% of the budget goes towards the infrastructure. Am I right about that? The engineering
commissioner?
Infrastructure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 72% is the total operating cost for the facilities division. So it's all the staff costs, any purchasing, anything like that, infrastructure, whatever it is, fuel, utilities, food, it's the entire budget for that division.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I just want to say I didn't spend 16 years on the school board. But I did spend 15 years as an engineer in the Navy. And I took three ships through an overhaul, as two of them as a chief engineer. I ran the overhaul. One of them was on the was out of Seattle. We shut we shut down a lot of the shipyards up in the Northwest. We also shut down a lot of shipyards up in the Northeast, and we moved a lot of our maintenance to the South, Long Beach and Avondale shipyards. Well, the reason why we did that is because of the expense of our facilities and our infrastructure and the cost of doing business. And why am I bringing all this up? There is, in fact, a cost savings when you look at outsourcing and moving and using facilities in other regions of the country. When I looked at this pie chart on the costs, where we're spending almost $700 million on the facilities, I think we could have a large cost savings if we do outsourcing. I just want to make that comment.
Okay, thank you, Representative Leidiger. And before we go any further, to go to two groups here. First of all, do we have some people for Network in here from Better Futures? Could you stand up and be acknowledged, please? Good to have you here. Thanks for coming. And then also a charter school group here, back in the back there. Thank you for coming today, and I hope we're learning something here. Thank you. All right. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Larson got away. Something concerned me that she said, and I don't know if she covers also the mental health area, but apparently you do. I can understand the if they have to go through a little bit of discomfort or something, we all do, but I'm concerned if that also applies to the mental health area, that you only look at what is keeping the person from, let's say, not being able to be kept incarcerated or not kept incarcerated, but from causing problems while they're in. If that was the only kind of mental health we were doing, I'm very concerned, because I look at mental health as something that carries on to once they get out into my community. And I'm extremely concerned if that idea of just doing what's necessary for them while in prison also guides your mental health, because then that's a huge problem. So maybe you could answer that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, you're correct. About 95% of our offenders will be going back into the community. So we do care about their entrance back to the community. What I said is that we provide a level of care to ensure that the offender can function safely and appropriately while they're in prison. And that includes their mental health issues. We have what are called supportive living services units, for example. So if we know that somebody is having difficulties getting up day to day, taking their medications on time, getting to chow, getting to their job, we'll place them in one of these units, one of these supportive living services units, to ensure that they get where they need to get and that they're taking their medications when they need to take them and that they're showering and that they're getting up and going to work. So we kind of look at how are they functioning in prison and do they need to have whatever service in order to function appropriately and safely in prison. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Muller, you have a follow-up?
As a follow-up, and that's exactly my concern, is what you're saying, because those people come out and they come into my community, and what you're saying is they're not getting what's needed when they come into my community. They're getting what's needed to make them safe in prison. That's a huge issue with me, and I think if that's what's going on, we have to change that, because that comes out and the people of the state are, in my view, may be harmed by that approach. So this is an area I'm going to follow up on a lot, because...
And Ms. Larson, I'm going to go ahead and let you respond. We want to make sure we've got plenty of time for the Department of Public Safety as well.
Sure.
So,
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, we actually have four levels of mental health services that are provided in our prison setting, and they're provided by both licensed and unlicensed mental health professionals. That first level is kind of, and I'll go really quickly, but that first level is kind of the outpatient groups, the self-help groups, AA, NA. The second level of services are those provided by our mental health staff, so the licensed psychologists, the licensed professional counselors, and that includes outpatient intervention, psychoeducational groups, psychotherapy groups, and individual psychotherapy. Level three is those supportive living services that I talked about. So we are giving them the services that they need, and giving them the tools that they need for when they get released. So those supportive living services are for the chronically mentally ill and kind of the low functioning, and as I described it earlier, we're there to, you know, we have staff there to help them get to work and take their medications, as well as using mentors. And then we have level four services, which are for more acute mental illnesses. That's our mental health unit at Oak Park Heights, which is a 48-bed residential facility. And then we use that for both the acute mental illnesses, for medication management, for persons who have episodes of psychosis. We also have release planners in our system, primarily for the severely mentally ill. And those release planners work with our offender population to get them prepared to leave us and go to the community. So they hook them up with a community mental health provider. They make sure that they have a psychiatric appointment if they're on medications to ensure that they get their medications refilled. They also work to get them on one of the state's health insurance programs so that they have ongoing health coverage. So that was a really very brief snapshot of our mental health services.
Mr. Chair, we'll follow up later on this.
Okay. All right, folks, we sure appreciate you being here today. And unless you have any closing comments, we'll let you go. Okay, next up we have the Department of Public Safety. Commissioner Doman.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'll
let Jared get out of the way there. You can go ahead and have a seat, Commissioner, if you want, while they're getting that ready. And members, this is Commissioner Mona Doman, who we have in front of us today, her first day on the job, and she has a long and outstanding career in law enforcement and former chief and also the first woman Department of Public Safety Commissioner, I think, in Minnesota. And welcome. It's very good to have you here. It's quite an accomplished career you have. And I think, members, in the packet, we have a news release of Commissioner Doman's appointment. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And members of the committee, I appreciate being here. And as you stated, this is my first few hours on the job, and so we're delighted to be here. Are we ready to begin?
We sure are. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Great. I appreciate that you have something in your packet. I won't bore you with the details of my past life, but we are here to give information on the Department of Public Safety's fiscal year 2012-2013 biennial budget. The focus of, or the mission of the Department of Public Safety is to protect the citizens and communities in the state of Minnesota. And we do that with a focus on six obvious areas, but I'll state those. It's prevention, preparation, response, recovery, education, and enforcement. The direct focus is on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, like you talked about with the Department of Corrections a lot, regarding efficiency and effectiveness. And then paramount to our operations throughout the state certainly is maintaining public trust and the development of strong partnerships both in the private and public sectors. The Department of Public Safety divisions that we're going to talk about this morning that are under the funding jurisdiction of this committee are the State Fire Marshal's Office, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the Office of Justice Programs, Emergency Communications Networks, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And we have representatives from each of those divisions with us. But at this time, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison, who is very well prepared to give this presentation this morning in light of the fact that we've been together now for a few hours this morning. Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner Doman. And Commissioner Ellison, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellis, and I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Public Safety. We've been before this committee before and have given you an overview, and I know you've had an extensive overview of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. But what we will do today is just, again, give you a brief overview of each of our divisions and the governor's recommendations for the 12 and 13 biennial budget. Economic forecast that was released yesterday changes some of the budget change items that I'm going to be talking about today. And so we didn't really have time to take them out of our PowerPoint. So I'll just tell you as we go along which ones are no longer applicable. To start out, it's the recommendation for the 12-13 biennium includes $327.6 million from all funds. That represents a 6.6% decrease from fiscal year 10 and 11 to reflect changes to the forecast base as well as budget change items. The budget change items now are a little bit different, as I mentioned. So the police and firefighter health care reimbursement change item and the fire safety account transfer are no longer being proposed. So as we get to those, I'll just skip over them. What we will be talking about, though, is a disaster assistance match request, the Network for Better Futures request, and the armor maintenance and operations request. The governor's budget for 12-13 for public safety includes state government special revenue of $137,487,000, which is 42%. A miscellaneous special revenue of $26,764,000. A general fund appropriation of $159,430,000, or 49%. And trunk highway funding of $3.882 million, or 1%. The expenses by category are payments to individual, $2,734,000. A compensation of $69,329,000. Operating, which is all costs other than payroll costs, includes $83,546,000. Local assistance, grants, and aids that we pass through to other agencies, $93,294,000, or 28%. And then basically transfer to other agencies or other funds includes $78,660,000. And that largely consists of the money that we collect for the 911 and armor program and transfer. First of all, we'll talk about the State Fire Marshal Division, and that is just for your reference in your budget books, pages 60 to 67. The mission of the State Fire Marshal Division is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment. Fire Marshal services include investigation, enforcement, regulation, emergency response, data collection, and public education. The State Fire Marshal proposed budget for fiscal years 12 and 13 is $8,574,000, and this funding comes from the Fire Safety Special Revenue Account. These are the change items, one of the change items that we will not be discussing as a result of the economic forecast for yesterday. And this is the second one that we will not be discussing because of the economic news we received yesterday. Alcohol and gambling enforcement, their mission, and again, that's on pages 91 to 97 in your budget book. The mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor state tribal gaming compacts. Alcohol enforcement area of the division includes alcohol beverage licensing and permits, brand label registration. They investigate alcohol-related complaints and investigations of licensed premises, alcohol promotion and advertising, imposition of civil penalties, enforcement of underage drinking laws, retail alcohol vendor enforcement program. The gambling enforcement of the division includes the licensing and of manufacturers and distributors of gambling equipment. They assure the compliance with state tribal compacts. They do gambling, criminal enforcement, and investigation. For the 12-13 biennium, the proposal is for $4.472 million, $3.166 million of that coming from the general fund, and from the special revenue fund, $1,306,000. And the special revenue monies are derived from the Indian Nation compacts, criminal background check fees that we charge, and gambling forfeitures. Homeland Security and Emergency Management, their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. Their services include emergency preparedness, planning and response, pre-disaster mitigation, post-disaster recovery services, critical infrastructure protection, Community Right to Know Act, the School Safety Center, training exercises and simulations, coordination of statewide and volunteer resources, and also they administer a lot of federal grants that pass through to local units of government. Their funding for the biennium, the proposal is $5.05 million. From the general fund, $3,704,000, special revenue, $1,208,000, and from the environmental fund, $138,000. As I mentioned previously, HSEM is a pass-through for sizable federal dollars. In fiscal year 11, HSEM will expend approximately $28 million in local assistance to cover over 300 local governments and other entities. This is a change item because of the floods that we experienced previously. This is something that occurs on a pretty regular basis. The amount of money that we have in our base budget does not cover the state's share of the costs of the disasters. So this change item is for the 25% match to the federal funds that we are receiving for repairing the damage that was done in the 2009 flooding. The recommendation is for $2,043,000 in new money. This is a one-time appropriation, and again, it matches the federal emergency management assistance funding that we receive for repairing the damage from the floods. Next is the Office of Justice Programs, and that's located on pages 105 to 114. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist victims of crime. Their services include crime victim reparations, the Crime Victim Justice Unit, grants to local programs for assistance to crime victims, and those include general crime, abused children, battered women, and domestic violence, sexual assault, emergency, and an emergency grant program. They have a training and communications division, a statistical analysis center, and they provide justice and community grants to reduce crime, reduce delinquency, reduce drug abuse, and reduce violence in the state of Minnesota. The 12-13 biennial budget recommendation is for $71.7 million. $71,482,000 of that from the general fund and $192,000 from the special revenue fund. In addition to programming, OJP administers state and federal grants to nonprofits and local units of government. A change item under this area is the Network for Better Futures. You'll see that change item described on page 18. The governor is recommending a $2.9 million one-time grant to complete and assess a currently operated demonstration pilot program for reentry services. And we do have people here today from the network if you have specific questions about their programming. Next is emergency communications networks, and that's on pages 115 to 118. Their mission is to utilize emerging technologies to provide the most comprehensive emergency communication networks available. By developing professional partnerships and collaborating with our customers, we will deliver customer-focused network solutions that enhance public safety. First of all, we have the 911 area of emergency communication services. Through that program, we collect a monthly fee that's assessed upon all wired, wireless, and packet-based telecommunications services. And then we enter into contracts with telephone companies to provide the 911 network, and we administer grants to public safety answering points that are located throughout the state, provide technical assistance to those public safety answering points, and we're developing a migration strategy for the next generation of 911 so that we will be able to transmit digital data through the 911 system. The other area within emergency communications networks is the ARMR system, or the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response. That's oftentimes referred to as the 800 megahertz emergency communication system. What we're doing is implementing a statewide standards-based shared digital trunk communications network for state and local emergency responders, developing Minnesota's bottom-up local and regional governance structure for that radio system, and implementing the statewide interoperability program with the focus of developing interoperable communications for routine, medium, and large-scale local events. As you recall from the history of this with 9/11, many emergency services people lost their lives because they couldn't communicate with one another. And so what we're doing is building out this system throughout the state of Minnesota so in the event of local emergencies or statewide emergencies, everybody will be able to communicate with each other in such events. The funding for the 12-13 biennium is $137.3 million from the 911 State Government Special Revenue Fund. The change item here, which is described in more detail on page 13 of your budget book, is for the radio system. It's an 800 megahertz, as I indicated, interoperable communication system for public safety personnel. The system is owned and operated by MnDOT, and so we transfer fees to MnDOT for the operation of that program. So we partner with MnDOT in this endeavor. And we are recommending that for the 12-15 special revenue appropriations to MnDOT for the ARMR maintenance and operations. So basically, this is a change item to transfer funding to MnDOT for the operations of that system.
Commissioner, in that respect, when will we be done with ARMR? When's a projected finish date where we're all completed and up to speed? And then will there be a maintenance along the way of a certain amount in layman's terms? Is your ARMR person here
Mr.
today?
Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Whitehead to come forward. I believe I know the answer, but I don't want to say in case I'm wrong.
And Mr. White, and I'm sure that if we needed more funding, you wouldn't want us to dip in one more time and delay it even more, I suppose.
No. By all means, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the acting director for the Emergency Communication Network. One of the responsibilities, obviously, is the armor system we're building in conjunction with the Department of Transportation. In answer to your question, we're on track to be done by the 2013 deadline for FCC narrowbanding. There's possibility of up to 20 towers out of 328 towers that may be in the final stages and not completed as of that date. But I'll tell you right now, MnDOT has transitioned over to the armor system statewide. There's at least 75% coverage. State Patrol will transition next summer completely. So we're on track to be completed on time and in budget.
How many counties ended up going their own way?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at the current time, we have about 70 counties that are looking at the transition. We have a few counties like Maurer County, Waseca County, had invested in analog VHF much earlier in the process, and they'll look at it again once they've amortized that equipment. In northwest Minnesota, there's a group of counties of approximately 15 or 13, I believe, that are predominantly committed to staying in VHF systems. We do have a backbone in place, and one of our strategies, obviously, is to make sure that we can interoperate with those people to the greatest degree possible. But we will have a statewide footprint of 95% coverage in every county of the state.
And after the completion date, what funding will be required in any maintenance or other than normal upkeep, or what's the continuation of armor? Does it end then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the change order should be the last appropriation for maintenance of the armor backbone. It's approximately $10 million per year that we're transferring from the 911 fund to provide for that maintenance. With that comes the ability where there is no cost for local units of government to operate on the backbone system. We fully cover the armor operating costs.
Mr. Whitehead, how are you doing on the grants, or how are they? Are they being very successful? The small departments that have to get the 800 megahertz mobiles and portables, they have to purchase many of them on their own, or the grants coming through, you think?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have one big grant that's provided about $8 million in funding that's gone out to the regions through regional radio boards. We have 7 regional radio boards, and they've allocated it amongst the counties, and hopefully they're taking into consideration their local units of government besides within the county. In addition to that, many of the fire departments have been very, very successful with fire grants. One of the advantages of the armor system is the fact that they can promote a truly interoperability backbone that they're transitioning to. So we've seen a number of very successful fire grants. We're not directly involved in that other than to comment that it clearly is consistent with our strategy. And then some of the Homeland Security, we take approximately $5 million of the state Homeland Security program every year, and we've allocated that to the regions, not only for infrastructure when the regions need infrastructures and the local governments need infrastructure, but also to use for subscriber radios. Now, I would note that subscriber radios are a big cost. There's no doubt about it. But the other side of the coin is they were all confronted with a big cost, no matter what, because of the 2013 deadline for narrowbanding, which in essence made most radio systems throughout the state obsolete, requiring agencies to replace their subscriber radios, portables and mobiles, and their basic communication systems. So it's a challenge. There's not enough grant money to go around. But we've tried to communicate as effectively as we can and help the different local units of government look for grant money. Predominantly, we work through the regional radio boards. Again, there's 7 regional radio boards: Northwest, Northeast, Central Minnesota, Southeast, South Central, and Southeast, and then finally in the metropolitan areas, the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board, and they're our key partners in continuing to work with local units of government, not only on the funding side, but also on the standard development side, to make sure that we truly do enhance interoperability to the greatest extent possible.
Okay, thank you much. Representative Kelly, did you have one for?
Yes.
Oh no,
Mr. Whitehead.
Oh.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify something? Deputy Commissioner Ellison said I may have left you with the impression there won't be an ongoing cost. There will be an annual cost. It's just that we've reached that point where we've got all the operating money into the budget. So there'll be approximately $10 million per year that will annually go to Department of Transportation to pay the ongoing operation and maintenance of the armor system. So if I left you with the wrong impression that this is a one-time transition, no, it isn't. It will be a continuing cost. But we have ramped that fee up, or that not that fee, but that cost up, so that every year we would not expect an increase any further in that amount that's being transferred.
That's a heck of a cost, $10 million a year, you say, for just the upkeep? Or just putting that into the build it, and then we're going to have to pay that much a year to upkeep it. What was it on the old system for upkeep?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can't really tell you what it is. Obviously, those costs come individually to every local unit of government that operates a radio system and so forth. I will tell you this is a third of a billion-dollar communications infrastructure, so $10 million is not a substantial amount when you look at the cost of our investment, and that's what it's going to cost to keep it operating and so forth. There are, as we get further into the system, there are some chances. There's one element of operating costs, which is called software assurance. You know, it's a radio system with a significant computer element to it that may decline over time and so forth. So that may, in fact, reduce as we move ahead with the over the next 15 to 20 years that we operate this system.
And we'll all have to hope that the feds don't want to find another place on the band for us in the future, higher or lower. So, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. White, this has been an ongoing process for quite a while. What year did we actually start looking at this as far as deciding on going with the implementation of it? What year was that?
Mr. White?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we began, obviously, the armor system began in the metropolitan area, was first implemented in 2001, and the 2002 legislation was when we adopted a legislature. They adopted a statewide plan to expand it. There was actually in 2002 some money was allocated, but we weren't able, it wasn't sufficient to get started in phase, what was referred to then as phase three. So phase three was actually funded in 2005, phase three being southeast Minnesota and then central Minnesota. Then in 2007 was when we funded phases 4, 5, and 6, in essence completing the system. Prior to proceeding with that allocation, the legislation required that we go back and review the coverage that we were providing, go back and do an assessment of the funding, was there enough estimated funding for the project and so on and so forth before we could finally begin construction in 2008. So MnDOT's actually, you know, 2008 to 2012 to build approximately 275 towers. We went back and we added 50 towers to make sure there was 95% coverage in every county, providing adequate coverage for local units of government. We reviewed the costs, and again, the cost study indicated that we would come in on budget, and we've actually done a little better given the nature of the economy since mm-hmm. that point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Actually, my question was really about now that we've set this up as our backbone, we all know that technology is changing daily, and we have different phones now than we did just a year ago. And how I know what a lot of these counties are struggling with is, do we make this investment because we know the technology is changing at such a rapid pace that they're concerned about spending that money when the next technology down the road may not be what we're after? So what I'm wondering is how have we kept up within the armor system with technology itself, because even the radios themselves have changed dramatically. So is this an actual backbone that we can expect to use with data and video and everything else so that we should actually be continuing to invest in this type of system, or do we need to be more mobile?
Mr. Whitehead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, from a public safety perspective, this is an extremely reliable, contemporary public safety radio system. The actual RF element, the Motorola backbone, is probably about a third of that cost. The other two-thirds are the towers and the microwave equipment that would go, if in fact we go, you know, start looking at data and so forth on a statewide basis. And I would actually assure you that we are very actively involved in the discussion of LTE. The industry, public safety, is looking at LTE. What most people will tell you, it's not ready for prime time yet. They haven't even specified a push-to-talk type technology. So what you see in your cell phones is for the consumer market. For a public safety market, the Armor system is state-of-the-art. Many states are in the process right now of implementing trunked radio systems very similar to this. It's a P25, APCO 25 standard-based system. In other words, an open standard that various producers can provide equipment to make sure that we're competitively pricing equipment. And ultimately, as it becomes, you know, at some point, and that's not anywhere in the foreseeable horizon, given the fact that it's a computer-based system. In other words, upgrades are built into it through software enhancements for quite some period of time. But we ultimately will have a strategy when, in fact, we do move to what you might think of as the broadband network, where we're doing voice, data, and wireless, all, you know, all those different functions on a common network. But that's a good 10 to 15 years away before it really becomes something that you can use for in a public safety market. And I'll, you know, there's a number of people involved in that discussion at a national level, and all of them will tell you categorically that, you know, you shouldn't be moving to LTE yet. Wait for that technology to mature. At some time, it may become public safety ready, but it clearly isn't now. So a market, you know, reasonably stated, for the next 10 years, this will be state-of-the-art contemporary radio system. At that point, you've got your towers, you've got your microwave backbone that are all adaptable to a different environment, and we're in the midst of that discussion and making sure that we're on top of it so that we can be prepared to discuss those issues.
And Mr. Chair, just to summarize then, Mr. Whitehead, that it's safe to say that roughly two-thirds of it would be a backbone that's adaptable, computer adaptable, like you say, interchangeable, maybe software, but we would probably have to be concerned maybe about the actual hardware, maybe a third of it, mean the radios and whatnot. Is that logical?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's a fairly good assessment of what I did state there, but even the radio RF element is adaptable through software enhancements to make sure that it's staying up and contemporary now also.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Whitehead, just had a question. You talked about towers and the necessity of towers and the cost of towers. I'm guessing, or just, I guess, inquiring if, with the number of towers that are already out there serving different purposes, does this equipment coexist, or can it exist on towers that are currently up to reduce the cost of having to build towers?
Mr. Whitehead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a possibility for that to occur. MnDOT is the one obviously in control of that. However, what they've found is that in most instances, the payback period on building our own towers about 3 years and so forth. We are actually coexisting, especially up in the northeast portion of the state. We are coexisting on towers to make sure that we get into a location where it's very difficult to put towers. But most of the towers are owned by MnDOT. Large portion of them are on DNR locations, fire tower locations, and so forth. So it's one of those alternatives that we certainly look at as we move ahead and try to not to overpopulate the state with towers, but by the same token, on a long-term basis, having our own towers that we control. Now, the other side of that, I would tell you, is that as part of the Armor project is for local units of government, we build a very sturdy, reliable, redundant tower system, and we've generally got excess capacity to provide for the local units of government to put their radio systems on for those that maintain their own equipment of some nature. So we've been open from that perspective of we have plenty of capacity to provide for some local unit governments and, in essence, in some occasions, let them take down their old tower and replace it with one of ours.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Doman, would it be okay if we had finished up a few minutes early? Because we're never going to get done. I see the lab guy, the predatory offender database guy, and other people and other divisions up there that will have lots of questions for us. Wondering if we're okay if we continue this, and rather than just get into it now and have to cut it off in a few minutes anyway?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, whatever you would wish, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here again.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome anytime. Yeah, Representative Grunhagen, we wanted to finish early, but go ahead.
You can ask for Deputy Commissioner Ellington. Under gambling enforcement, assurance of compliance with state tribal compacts, okay? And this question was given to me by a former state representative, or comment. And they said, within the compact, we have the right to audit the books of the tribe, but we've never done it. What's your response to that?
We could have a short answer, then we'll adjourn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am going to have Jim Arlt answer that question. He's director of that division.
Okay.
Okay. Can you give that answer in just a couple minutes?
I will certainly try.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and representatives, we are allowed to end up looking at the books. I'm not sure it would be quite accurate to say that we have the powers to actually audit the books. The books have typically have an independent audit done by the tribes. And we have looked at those in the past. I would say it probably hasn't been done in the last couple of years that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you very much, members. If there's nothing else, meeting adjourned.